the socialist political movement, and its various philosophies can be traced all the way back to the mid to late 1700s, rearing up during revolutionary movements. We're going to take a closer look at the various chapters in the Socialist Party this hour. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll examine the historical figures, the personalities who galvanized support for the Socialist Party, like Union leader Eugene Debs, and we'll learn how Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders fits into this historical timeline. Joining us now is Paul Heidemann. He's a doctoral student in sociology at New York University. He wrote a detailed history of the Socialist Party that was published last week in Jacobin, a magazine on socialist perspectives. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Take us back to what the conditions were like when the Socialist Party was born and how people were discontent with their plight, the common farmer being trapped by debtors. What was this time like?
Well, to understand the Socialist Party, I think it's important to see it as kind of the culmination of really a half century of social upheaval in the United States, beginning with the Civil War and the fight between the free states and the slave states. The Social War was a cataclysmic event. The Civil War is a cataclysmic event in American history. And in its aftermath, all kinds of social change began to kind of percolate through through society. So in the South, you had Reconstruction, right? The imposition of actual democratic governments for the first time on the southern states. You had, black people were allowed to vote, and there were really radical experiments in democracy in the United States. You had those. At the same time that Reconstruction was going on, the labor movement for the first time began to make its presence really felt in American society. You had during the Civil War, you had the formation of national labor unions. And in 1877, in particular, you had the Great Uprising, which was a massive railway strike that kind of announced to the United States that the kind of revolutionary upheavals that you had seen in Europe across much of the 19th century were going to happen in this country as well. That the United States wasn't immune from that kind of social upheaval. And so as, a movement for democracy, for African Americans, the movement for rights for workers, as these movements were taking off in the countryside, you also had a tremendous amount of discontent. In the aftermath of the Civil War in the South, many poor farmers, black and white, who either had managed to own a small amount of land of their own or were either tenant farmers who essentially rented another farmer's land season to season, found themselves trapped in a cycle of debt to either the big landlords who owned the land or to the merchants from whom they needed to rent their equipment or to buy their seeds for year to year. And this entire class found itself driven deeper into debt every year. Kind of every harvest cycle meant getting further and further locked into the trap. And so across the country, from Chicago to Texas, from New York to California, people in the lower classes in the United States found themselves really trapped, and the result of that was a massive wave of discontent that swept across the country in the decades following the Civil War. And the organization of the Socialist Party, I think, can be seen as the culmination of this wave and its organization into an effective kind of nationwide political force for really the first time.
Who were the people giving voice to these tenant farmers and so many people who didn't have a voice? Who were the personalities behind the Socialist Party in its early days?
Well, the most important personality is without doubt, Eugene V. Debs. Debs had been a leader going back to the 1880s in the railway unions in the United States. He was a railway union worker, and he had become a leader of what was the first attempt to organize all of the different railroad unions. Because back in these days, unions were organized not according to like everyone who works on a given railway is in one union, but rather that the engineers are in one union, the brakemen are in another union, kind of every individual job on the railways had its own union, and Debs tried to break through that and form a union of all the workers on a given railroad, and that attempt provoked a mighty backlash from the railway owners themselves, who saw what a threat it was. And Debs kind of first came to national attention when he defied an injunction that courts issued to try and stop a strike that he was leading, and he refused to stop and was imprisoned for it. And in that moment, Debs kind of became the symbol of this entire wave of discontent and of mobilization in American society at the time. So a populist newspaper ran a headline that says, "While Debs is in prison, no man is free." And Debs, worked with the populists and the Populist Party, which was organizing the farmers at the time. So Debs was working people who worked on the railroads. At the same time, the movement of farmers was coalescing into the Populist Party, and there were efforts to bring those two movements together, to bring the movements of people who worked in cities, who worked in factories, with the struggles of farmers. But they never quite coalesced, even though there was a tremendous degree of cooperation between the two. The Socialist Party was kind of the first time where those two movements were firmly under the same institutional roof.
You write in your piece that populist electoral efforts ran up against the same obstacles that have really dogged nearly every left electoral strategy since then, the Democratic Party and the power of money in politics. We can only help but think of the modern parallels here. I think Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders would have a lot to say about this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the political scientist Thomas Ferguson has talked about how in American democracy, there's really two filters to getting elected. The one filter that kind of everyone knows about is votes. You have to get enough votes if you're going to get into office, right? But there's a filter before that, which is to get to the stage where you can even be in a position to get votes, you have to get enough money to, to run a campaign, which in the United States cost, at this point, billions of dollars on the presidential level. And so, the one filter is, the Democratic filter that we think that, most of us think is a pretty good thing. No one should be in a position of power unless they have the consent of a majority of the people who could vote for them. But that first filter is power. Is, I think, not fully appreciated in American public life, but it's been a constant for, going back over the centuries. And the politics of the party system has been decisively shaped at any number of points by the changes in the requirements of that first filter.
Yeah, we're talking with Paul Heidemann. He is a PhD student in sociology at New York University, where his areas of research include political economy, labor, sociology, education, race, and ethnicity. He's also a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I must add. And his latest article on socialism was recently published in Jacobin, the magazine for socialist perspectives. You had a really, really in-depth history of the Socialist Party. Paul, paint a picture for us of Eugene Debs and the Red Special and the charisma this man was able to galvanize as he went across the country speaking on the ideals.
Yeah, Debs is a figure who's like we really haven't seen since. Even Sanders, who I think was tremendously charismatic in his own way, doesn't really touch the appeal that Debs had. So Debs, comes from a middle American family in Terre Haute, Indiana, and became a railway worker and a railway union leader. But from very early on, in his career as a political leader, he was known for an unbelievably kind of self-sacrificing and a moral rectitude that we certainly don't associate with politicians today. Debs was seen as uncorruptible, as someone who was not in this for himself in the slightest, but was doing everything he did. And he would tour the country, giving a couple speeches a day on train, and completely destroy his throat. He'd have to rest for months on end after his tours sometimes because of the schedule. And he would go to working class communities, to poor farming communities, and he would speak to thousands of people who would assemble to see him, and he would tell them things that they knew to be true about their lives, that they were exploited, that they were oppressed, that their lives were worse than they needed to be. And he would say all of this in a way that validated their entire lives, right? Like people, the poor workers in America this time grew up knowing that their lives were not as good as they should be, but they got no validation on that from official society whatsoever. And here comes this guy into town on a train, dressed in a suit, you know, speaking in the tones of kind of educated society and telling them everything they know to be true about their lives. You know, at a time in American history when, you know, this is happening in the progressive era America, at a time when, like, a lot of working-class Americans are actually being disenfranchised and having their vote taken away in the North through, like, anti-corruption laws, things like that, like the tightening up of voting restrictions. This is a time when the working class is actually losing its political voice in a lot of ways, and Debs is a figure who is, you know, using his entire being to throw working-class concerns onto the political agenda, and the loyalty that inspired in American workers and farmers is something that I think it can be hard to comprehend today. So, you know, like, people who saw his tours regularly compared him to Jesus Christ, right, to Jesus of Nazareth, as this kind of, like, this figure of impeccable morality who was denouncing the corruption of society as it exists and who was just totally selfless. And so there's, you know, there's funny stories about, like, when Debs is running for president against Taft, and they're in the same town at the same night, and the Socialist Party is charging a dime for admission to see Debs speak, and they're turning people away, they're turning boatloads of people away at the door. Meanwhile, on the other side of town, in some rich district, Taft is speaking, and it's free, and the hall is half empty. You know, that's the impact that Debs had on American political life. It was something, I think the ruling class at the time kind of had no idea how to deal with this guy.
But like any party, there was infighting in politics, which is very familiar. What were some of the early fractions going on inside the party that were splintering the Socialist Party?
So from early on, it became clear that people in the Socialist Party had really diametrically opposed ideas over what socialism was and how we would get there. So you had like people like Debs who saw socialism as a revolutionary movement that was going to overthrow capitalist society and replace it with in the language of the time they would call it the cooperative commonwealth, and it was something that was going to have to be won in a real battle with the powers that be. There were others at that time who saw socialism kind of more as a series of reforms that you could kind of build your way to socialism gradually by doing things like coming to power in a city and having municipal ownership of utilities and kind of expanding that to win on the national level and nationalize industry, and that there'd be kind of a slow series of reforms, the culmination of, at the end of which, capitalism would be done and we would be living in a socialist society. And, you know, that might sound like kind of like, a contest between pragmatists and utopians, but it really came down to something much deeper than that, in that it came down to how you viewed how capitalist society worked, whether capitalism was a society that would actually permit, slow reforms to build their way to socialism uninterrupted. And the leader of kind of the wing, the constructive socialists, they called themselves, was Victor Berger of Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Who built a socialist party machine in Milwaukee that outlasted, you know, most of the rest of the socialist party by decades. He built a very tight, very powerful machine based on, you know, mainly the German immigrant workers in the city and their unions. And in Milwaukee, he created kind of a model in miniature of the vision he hoped to see for socialism in the United States, which was, these kind of like municipal ownership, workers' cooperatives being encouraged by the government, all of this sort of thing. And so these different views came to real conflict in the party because they had implications that were just diametrically opposed. So in Milwaukee, for example, Berger would brag that we, the socialists, have opposed every strike that's ever occurred here because he saw, you know, most strikes as a kind of disorder and a kind of chaos in the orderly management of a society, of a city. Berger thought, you know, the socialists and the trade unions were powerful enough that they could sit down at the table with capitalists, with employers, and work something out, and that strikes were too unpredictable and too chaotic and would just jeopardize those efforts to kind of negotiate things from the top. Debs, on the other hand, thought that, you know, the working class, poor people in the United States, would get nothing without struggle like strikes, like with workers, you know, going into action against their employers. And so two visions like that in a party is a recipe for conflict. And that conflict kind of varied in intensity at various points, but ultimately I think it's the conflict between those two is what destroyed the Socialist Party at the end of the day.
We're talking with Paul Heidemann about the history of the socialist movement. He's a PhD student at New York University, also a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He wrote a history of the Socialist Party in the magazine Jacobin. It focuses on socialist perspectives. His article is titled The Rise and Fall of the Socialist Party of America, and we have it linked on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's hear your thoughts about socialism in America and what you remember about socialism in Milwaukee. Did you live through this time at 800-642-1234? What do you think of a capitalist society and the concentration of wealth in America? Do you see socialism as a fad, as a backlash to what is going on perhaps in Washington? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network.
You've got to join that one big union. You've got to join it by yourself. Everybody here will join it with you. You've got to join the one big union by yourself. If the road gets rough and rocky, and the hills get steep and high.
We're continuing our conversation now with Paul Heidemann about the history of socialism in America and its recent resurgence in our political landscape. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, filling in for a vacationing Kathleen Dunn. The early 20th century socialist movement has experienced a renaissance of late, and we're exploring its history, its struggles, its deep roots in Wisconsin, and specifically Milwaukee. Milwaukee had three socialist mayors, and we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the modern form of democratic socialism? Do you worry about big government? Do you back socialist ideals in, say, housing, education, and healthcare? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234 or post your views on socialism on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Paul, I want to take us back now to World War I and where we see 1919, basically, the end of the Socialist Party. What brought its ruin?
Yeah, so, you know, the Socialist Party got nearly a million votes in 1912 and looked like it was poised to break onto the American political stage in a major way and become, you know, a real contender for president, all kinds of positions. By 1919, that was all over. And I think to understand that, you have to understand the way that World War I transformed the inner politics of the Socialist Party. So the Socialist Party actually opposed World War I for the most part. You know, when the war broke out in Europe, basically every socialist in the United States said, we want no part of this war. This is a war that capitalists of Europe are fighting amongst themselves. They're making the working class fight for them. We want nothing to do with it. As United States involvement in the war drew closer and closer and became inevitable, that kind of consensus began to fracture. And you had a number of socialists who became either vocally pro-war or kind of covertly pro-war. And this introduced a kind of a new dimension of schism into the party, right? It's one thing to have differences over direction, where you have like Victor Berger in Milwaukee, and then you have, let's say, a lot of left-wing socialists in Ohio, and they're each kind of doing their own thing. They're fighting, but they're living together in the same party. In the conditions of war and the repression that always accompanies war in the United States, it becomes much harder for those two groups to live under the same house. And so as moderate socialists and more numbers began to kind of support the war or at least oppose any efforts for the Socialist Party to kind of really move to the forefront of opposition to the war, those schisms became wider and wider. And one of the things driving these was that the left wing of the party, which had always been subordinate to kind of the wing around Berger and the New York leader, Morris Hillquit, the left wing moved forward. And partially this is because the left wing was the most anti-war, and there was actually massive opposition to American participation in World War I across American society. It's kind of a history that's totally been forgotten, but like draft boards across the country reported huge troubles filling their quotas. As you know, a lot of young men just didn't show up to their draft board. People actually attacked draft offices and burned the records. You know, people think that's like something only students did in the 1960s during Vietnam, but that was something everyday Americans were doing during World War I. And as the left kind of mobilized around this sentiment and began to coalesce and assert itself as a greater force in the party, the right wing began to feel kind of more and more threatened. And so conflict between the two reached a fever pitch in kind of 1918, 1919, as the right wing leadership of the party basically began repressing the left wing internally, kind of stopping them from holding meetings, barring them from speaking, expelling them. And then by the spring of 1919, the right wing had basically decided that even if they had to expel all of the left, that was a price worth paying, because allowing the left to take over the party, they thought would mean the party's ruin. And so in spring of 1919, the leadership of the Socialist Party actually expels a majority of the party's membership in the name of kind of stopping the left from ruining it. And, you know, the irony there is that in expelling a majority of the membership, they dealt the party a blow from which it would never recover. And that's, I think, one of the tragedies of American socialism is that, you know, the socialists like Victor Berger, like Morris Hillquit, kind of the moderate, pragmatic socialists, basically destroyed the party in order to save it.
It was self-inflicted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take a call now. Earl from Medford. Hi, Earl.
So I would bring up Frank Seidler. He was a mayor when I was growing up, and he seemed to outlive socialism or be a part of it, but you didn't hear too much other than him. And I think he was the last mayor who was socialist.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit, Paul, about Frank Seidler?
So I actually don't know a ton about Seidler. I haven't studied Milwaukee in depth. I do know that the party in Milwaukee, as the caller said, absolutely outlasted the party just about everywhere else, largely because of the base that Victor Berger had built there, right? He built this kind of independent kingdom of socialism, almost, based on kind of the unions there and the large immigrant population, and was able to keep that running even after the rest of the party had been destroyed, because, you know, once you kind of get into power in a city like that and are able to deliver the goods, it creates a foundation for staying in power that if you're always in opposition, you just don't have. And those were kind of the highest fruits of Victor Berger's strategy, was the longevity of the socialists in Milwaukee that you saw in Seidler maintaining his mayoralty, you know, decades after the Socialist Party had really ceased to be a factor in politics almost everywhere else.
Earl, thanks for your call. Let's now go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, and thank you for accepting my call. I'd just like to inform the listening audience and perhaps your guest of the Socialist Labor Party of America that was founded by Daniel DeLeon, I believe in the year 1889. And the party was quite active for a number of years, advocating the concept or a program of industrial democracy through the formation of a socialist industrial unions, which would be assume the ownership, control, and administrative duties of running the industries of the United States. The party ran political candidates for president and vice president in various state offices up to about the middle of the 1990s, and the party just dissipated, but it maintains a website, slp.org, and any of your interested listeners in the audience can access that page and download some of its literature and perhaps become more informed about the Socialist Labor Party.
Paul?
Yeah, the Socialist Labor Party is a fascinating piece of American history because its history actually goes directly back to Marx himself. You know, when Karl Marx was in England and trying to coordinate a socialist movement worldwide, they formed what was called the International Working Men's Association. And there was an American branch of it that was mainly German immigrants, some, you know, old friends of Marx who had moved to the United States. Marx himself was actually contemplating moving to Texas at one point, which is an interesting history to think about. But there was a large population of German immigrants to the U.S., many of whom had been participants in the German Revolution of 1848, and they formed the American branch of the International Working Men's Association, the First International, as it's called. And that party had, you know, a few thousand members, really, consistently from about the 1870s until the 1880s, when it changed its name to the Socialist Labor Party and became a different force. And it always, the SLP's kind of longevity is fascinating to think about. There are very few groups in the history of the American left that have lasted that long. And it was always kind of an uncompromising voice for the very left edge of American socialism. And, you know, Daniel De Leon, the leader of the party for the decade, you know, 1890s, 1910s, was known kind of on the rest of the left by people like Debs as just an uncompromising polemicist, the kind of guy you really didn't want to cross words with because he would burn you bad. And that, unfortunately, led to the SLP being rather isolated for much of its history. So the Socialist Party was actually founded out of people who left the Socialist Labor Party, Morris Hillquit, people in New York around cities like Rochester, who were dissatisfied with the party's kind of remaining at this small numbers of just a few thousand, and thought that there could be something bigger. And when they merged with Eugene Debs and Victor Berger's organization, that's where the Socialist Party of America comes from. So the SLP is kind of always in the background in this history as this really interesting group that never kind of broke out the way the Socialist Party did, but absolutely left its mark on history.
Thank you so much, John, for your call. We're talking with Paul Heidemann. He's a doctoral student in sociology at New York University, discussing the history of socialism in America and what it looks like today. You've talked a lot about painting us a portrait of this Victor Berger and where he came from and how he was. He also started a couple of newspapers in Milwaukee and socialist newspapers in Milwaukee. How big of a role did the press play in shaping policy in the Socialist Party?
So the socialist press was absolutely crucial to the party's ability to reach an audience, to maintain an internal coherence, and to have kind of a lively intellectual political life. And at the time, the socialist press was massive. There were hundreds of newspapers, socialist newspapers and magazines across the country. You know, you'd find them in like a small county in Kansas would have its own socialist paper. And then there were the big ones, right, like the Appeal to Reason, also published out of Kansas, which had a readership in the hundreds of thousands and was, you know, as one of the main, one of the most read publications in the country at the time. And these magazines really helped bind the party together by giving socialists all over the country a venue to debate their ideas with one another, a way for them to kind of talk to one another and report their experiences from which they could draw conclusions about what strategies would work and what didn't. They were absolutely crucial. And actually, a lot of them have been archived online now. So, like, the International Socialist Review, which was one of the party's main intellectual journals, you can find the whole thing online. If you just, you know, go to Google, search International Socialist Review, it'll be one of the first things that comes up. And they're fascinating to go back and read and see the debates that were waged in the party and see the way that early American socialists thought about the problems that they were confronting. And in my opinion, you know, see how a lot of the problems they were confronting are actually quite similar to a lot that we're confronting today.
Let's take a call now again at 800-642-1234. David from Milwaukee. Hi, David.
Yes, hello. And Mr. Heidemann, I'd just like to add, I think that there will always be some sort of push for socialist values of some sort, simply because it's juxtaposed within a capitalist system that does not, on a regular basis, represent the views of the middle class. I noticed that, you know, when I travel, I live in Milwaukee, but when I travel, you can see a difference. It's still, the remnants of socialism, the sewer socialists in Milwaukee, are still very evident in the city's design and its attitude. And you do not always see that elsewhere in America. And I still experience today in Milwaukee, you know, much of an emphasis on the middle class and those values that were represented by the socialists throughout the first half of the 20th century in Milwaukee.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's cities across the country whose kind of very architecture has been shaped by the presence of socialists and by a working class movement, and that you can still feel today. And if you know where to look, you see them everywhere. So, you know, I live in New York now, and New York is a city that's been shaped in the same way, where, you know, there's all these housing developments that were funded by unions back in the day as, like, you know, good, affordable, middle class housing. And Milwaukee has something very similar with the legacy of working class cooperatives and that kind of thing there that have, even as kind of like their history has been forgotten a lot of the time, and they're no longer run by people who are socialists who want to replace capitalism. These institutions continue to shape our lives, and yeah, I absolutely agree for the better.
Well, David, thanks so much for your call. Paul, help us understand the issues that you saw of the Socialist Party in the early 1900s versus what we're seeing take root today through the Democratic Socialists of America.
So I think to step back a little bit, I think that, like, there's some very similar problems that socialists were confronting then and are confronting today. So, you know, the union movement in America, union density is what, around 8 or 9% in the United States today. You know, unions have been pushed to the background as kind of a minimal force in American politics. And the years around the turn of the century, unions were also, you know, not a real force in American politics. They hadn't yet broken through. So I think we're, in terms of the basic task of civilizing capitalism, which is, you know, the most immediate task socialists always have, we're confronting a lot of the same dynamics today, because we've lost so much ground over the past four decades. And then, so I think the resurgence of socialism today is absolutely a reflection of that. Like the caller said, as long as you have kind of capitalism making people's lives unlivable, you're going to see socialism as a response. People are going to respond in a way that says we have to get rid of this whole system. And so, you know, today you see socialist groups across the country growing. So Democratic Socialists of America has experienced massive growth and thousands of members. Groups like Socialist Alternative, like the International Socialist Organization, are growing. On the socialist far left, which I've been on for some time now, there's a growth right now and an excitement that I've never seen before. I think it has to do with, you know, with Bernie Sanders' campaign kind of letting socialists come out of the closet, letting people know that, like, they're not the only ones who think that the entire system is wrong. And also, I think just a whole generation growing up in the shadow of the financial crisis of 2008 and seeing that, you know, they're not going to be a whole bunch of new jobs waiting for them at some point. The likelihood of them getting out of the coffee shop, stopping being a barista, getting a stable job that'll allow them to have wages, to go on vacation, all of that kind of thing, as the hopes for all of that recede, even as the financial crisis moves further and further into the past, I think it's no surprise that you see more and more people willing to look to socialism as the answer.
We're talking with Paul Heidemann. He's a sociology doctoral student at New York University. We're discussing the history of socialism in America and where it's appearing today. His recent article on the roots of the Socialist Party appeared in Jacobin, a magazine of socialist perspectives. You can add your voice to this conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know more about socialism? What tenets do you want to see embraced by Democrats? What does the future of socialism look like to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried.
First, we're picking up our conversation with Paul Heidemann. His research areas include political economy, labor sociology, education, race, and ethnicity. He's a sociology PhD student at NYU. He wrote a detailed history on the Socialist Party that was published in Jacobin last week. We have a link on it, by the way, at the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. You can post your thoughts on socialism on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We were, Paul, getting a little bit closer to present day, and I want to take a moment to talk about Bernie Sanders' momentum and what he brings to the Democratic Socialists of America. He said Eugene Debs is someone he admires. Let's listen to Sanders' speech from June 16th of last year. It was soon after Hillary Clinton had secured enough delegates to get the Democratic Party's nomination for president.
During this campaign, we won more than 12 million votes. We won 22 state primaries and caucuses. We came very close, within 2 points or less, in five more states. In other words, our vision for the future of this country is not some kind of fringe idea. It is not a radical idea. It is mainstream. It is what millions of Americans believe in and want to see happen.
Paul, would you consider it to be mainstream now?
In some ways, yeah. The only difference I think I would have is that I think the mainstream is becoming more radical. I think it is a radical vision, and that's a good thing. So many of the things that Sanders talked about in the campaign that he campaigned on, like, you know, free college tuition, raising the minimum wage, the government actually supporting unions, single-payer health care. I mean, these things would change American society radically and for the better. You know, the United States is a society today in which tremendous amounts of people are suffering deprivation because of our society's unwillingness to provide them with the basic means for having a happy life, you know, a happy, fulfilling life. So I think that would be a radical change for us to move towards a society in which they began to have that. And I think it's becoming more mainstream as a result of, you know, just for so many years, the kind of efforts to tinker with it little by little have delivered so few results. Like I said before, I think Sanders' campaign was really kind of a coming out party for American socialism and for people to realize that, like, they're just not as isolated as they had thought, and that there are millions of people who agree with them.
Let's take another caller now, David from Oshkosh. Hi, David.
Hi, Kathleen. Sorry, I had you on speakerphone while I was on hold. I apologize. I just wanted to call here because I think there needs to be a defense of capitalism throughout this conversation. Capitalism itself has been responsible for bringing a billion, with a B, people out of poverty over the last century. This was a study that was done. I tried Googling it while I was on hold, either by Fee or by the Cato Institute. There was another study that was done from a professor at the Hawaii University on democide, which shows that socialism has been directly caused the death of, I forget how many hundreds of millions of people off the top of my head, but it is the second leading cause of death behind insects. Mosquitoes are the only thing that causes more death than socialism. This is an just appalling conversation that I'm hearing right now, and I think one of the biggest lies that has been perpetrated on the American public is directly out of Bernie Sanders, who has convinced an entire generation that socialism means caring about social issues. It doesn't at all. It is a state-sponsored run business, and there is nothing good that comes out of it. The only silver lining thing that I can find is a public library, and that's even questionable at that, because there's many private libraries that function at a much higher ability than public institutions.
And Paul, what would you say to that pushback from the side of capitalism?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, people have been making arguments like that for a very long time, and I think there's a reason that it's become less and less convincing, particularly, like I said, to people who have grown up in the shadow of the financial crisis. You know, those arguments have been said forever, but for people who grow up and who see, you know, a society where the life expectancy for, you know, middle-class white women is actually declining, right, that the death rates from suicide, from opioid addiction are skyrocketing, right? That's an index that something is deeply wrong with our society, and that's the end point of a society which for 40 years has said, let the market rip, right? We're going to shred the safety net. We are going to encourage the bosses and their efforts to crush the unions, and we're going to let each person get what the market will give them. And what we've seen is that it's resulted in a society that has become more unequal, that people's lives in the richest country on earth, the richest country that has ever existed, hundreds of thousands of people are killing themselves through drug addiction, through opioid abuse, through alcoholism. There's an epidemic in our society. That's not a society that's going well, and I think that's directly traceable to the policy path we've been on for the past years. And you know, again, if middle class white women's mortality rate is going up, you know, there's so many groups in our society. There's a saying in kind of sociology around race, that when white America catches a cold, black America has pneumonia, right? So if this is what's happening to white women, we know that there are other groups in our society are catching it even harder right now. So there's a reason that 30%, some polls, even a majority of people under 30 prefer socialism to capitalism, and Bernie Sanders isn't the main reason for that, right? Those polls were showing that before Bernie Sanders really came to the center of media attention. I think he played a role in helped organizing that and helped kind of coalesce that, but people were thinking that before Sanders. It wasn't Sanders that convinced people that capitalism wasn't working. It was people looking around, evaluating their own lives and drawing their own conclusions from it. I think that's why those kind of arguments have become so much less convincing to people.
Well, David, thank you so much for your call. Let's now go to Ron from La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yes, what I'm hearing here is sort of, I suppose you could call it the hidden history of the United States going on, the history of socialism. I do know something about it. I know John Goethe did a long history of miniseries of Milwaukee's political history. And I think if the socialists had made more inroads into the political and economic life of this country in the 1920s, it might have, by redistributing the wealth of the country back then more equitable manner, we might have avoided a Great Depression, because the stock market crashed, because I think there was a concentration of wealth at the top, namely in the stock market. And the middle class wasn't, and the rural areas were already hurting in the 1920s. It didn't just start with the Dust Bowl in the 30s. And after the stock market crash, this country was ripe for revolution in 1932.
Paul, how would you react to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you go back and you read the history of the New Deal, so much of it is kind of improvised. You know, so Roosevelt ran on a platform of balanced budgets when he was contesting the election. He wasn't running on this massive plan for totally changing the way the U.S. economy works. I find it fascinating to think, like, if the Socialist Party hadn't imploded in 1919, if it had continued to be a massive force in American politics, what might the response to the Depression have looked like? The New Deal was decisively shaped by workers' struggle that took place during the Great Depression. You know, so that the expansion of aid, unemployment insurance, for example, was driven as unemployment offices across the country faced down mobs of workers demanding more money. And if that kind of sentiment had found more, you know, organizational vehicles like what the Socialist Party had been a decade before, had been more organized, more powerful, I think we could have seen a much more radical political development during the New Deal that is really interesting to contemplate.
We're talking with Paul Heidemann, who has recently written an article titled The Rise and Fall of the Socialist Party of America. We're looking at the history of the Socialist Party and your input as well. Thank you so much, Ron, for your call. Let's next go to Mark in Madison. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to add?
Well, first of all, there's a wonderful book called Labor's Untold Story by a couple of professors at the University of Chicago. It's distributed by the United Electrical Workers, and it really goes into fascinating history that none of us ever hear about in the history books. But I was around during the 60s when the New Left was organizing against the war in Vietnam and on several social issues, and it's curious to hear the how the Socialist Party committed suicide. Well, the Students for a Democratic Society committed suicide in a similar manner. At that time, the Progressive Labor Party Workers' Student Alliance was the largest component of SDS, and then that Bernadine Dorn, Paul Ayers, I think, was the guy. They were the Revolutionary Youth Movement faction. And what they did when they saw that they were going to lose the election for the head of SDS, this was at the NC in Chicago at the Coliseum in 1969, they decided to form their own group and expel the majority of SDS. And as a result, the minority became kind of this violent bomb-throwing part of, you know, the anti-war movement, and put a few bombs here and there and got a very bad reputation and basically ceased to exist very quickly. But
And Mark, I'm going to jump in here. So, Paul, another instance of self-inflicted wounds.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I would say the key difference to understanding SDS's trajectory and the Socialist Party is that the Socialist Party was, at the end of the day, rooted in the American working class. You know, it was an organization of union members, of workers, of people who were fighting in a very direct way for their own lives and their own livelihoods. Students for Democratic Society was a student organization, and its political development really comes out of the era of McCarthyism in the United States, when the state and when employers worked systematically together to sever any connection between the kind of American radical tradition and the American working class. So, you know, like left-leaning unions were expelled from the CIO under state pressure, all of this kind of thing. And that meant that American radicalism was in a large degree unmoored for many of the decades that follow, and SDS's development really reflects that. I mean, I think SDS was heroic in all kinds of ways in their opposition to the Vietnam War, and you know, the many projects they started, the way they developed out of the Black Freedom Movement. I think there's a lot to praise in SDS, but I think the fact that McCarthyism had succeeded in really alienating socialism from the working class meant that the politics of SDS were always going to be kind of more unstable, less rooted in kind of the daily struggles of people to survive, and that meant that, like, you know, the development of one faction into the Weather Underground, right, into this kind of, like, completely unhinged and very destructive sect, was a lot easier than anything that could happen in the Socialist Party. So I think it's absolutely another kind of sad chapter in the American left of the of an organization that's at once very inspiring and has a very sad end.
Paul, as we wrap up here really quickly, I know historians don't like to talk about the future, but you're a sociologist, so I have an opening here. What do you see in your crystal ball for socialism in America here coming in the future?
So sociologists have no fear of making predictions. So I'm at this point, I'm very optimistic. I think the growth of the socialist left in the United States is an exciting development, and it means that there's people for struggles ahead. I was at the Women's March in January. A million people in Washington D.C. That was incredible to be surrounded by so many people who wanted to fight. I think the upcoming women's strike on March 8th promises to continue that momentum. So I think I think we're in for a period of a lot of attacks on workers and oppressed people in the United States, but I think that the prospects for fighting back are brighter than they've been in a long time, and I'm very hopeful about that.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Paul Heidemann is a doctoral student in sociology at New York University. His recent article is in Jacobin, a magazine of socialist perspectives. It's titled The Rise and Fall of the Socialist Party of America. And we can continue this discussion over on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Tomorrow at this time, we'll look at the quirky and fascinating conservation strategies to save tortoises on the Galapagos Islands. You'll want to make sure you tune in to hear about how Judas goats were used to save wildlife on the islands. Should be fascinating. And stay with us after the news. We're going to look at the growing popularity of Stand Your Ground laws. Thanks to producer Scotty Myers with on-air production help today from Jennifer Dargan. The technical director is Dave Potraz. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for the Kathleen Dunn Show. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Stick around.